Today, covering Britain in the EU for 47 years. And, after many months, the government finally makes a decision on Huawei.
I've worked for this for 25 years. I was the Prime Minister who led Britain into the community.
In Strasbourg, it was French protocol which struck the note for Mr. Heath's welcome with an ornate flourish. They wrote Beethoven's Ode to Joy above his name, a warm prelude to the symbolic signatures under his hand, which have now paved the way for Britain to enter Europe.
We're neither in favour of being in Europe on principle or being out of the common market on principle. It depends on the terms and how the market itself develops.
But it's not only a question of prosperity. It's a question of peace and security.
Success depends upon dispersing power and decisions away from the centre. And it would be absurd for us in Europe to move in the opposite direction.
We are sometimes uneasy partners for our colleagues in Europe. Often Britain is the grit in the European oyster.
It is our destiny to lead in Europe. And Europe needs us. But we have a vision of Europe. We want a people's Europe.
There is no old Europe, no new Europe, no East or West Europe. There is only one Europe, and it is our home Europe.
The question mark is already there. Ignoring it is not going to make it go away.
Brexit means Brexit.
We depart from the EU on the 31st of January, and at that point Brexit will be done. It will be over.
It's been 47 years with 10 prime ministers, many of their leaderships dominated by the question of Europe. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, how Britain's love affair with the European Union fell apart. John Palmer, I've covered a number of EU Council meetings in Brussels. You walk into this vast atrium and there are row after row of journalists hunched over laptops or huddled around media advisors. There's a huge bustling canteen and rooms set out for middle of the night press conferences with European prime ministers and presidents. You first headed there in 1974 as The Guardian's Brussels correspondent to cover meetings then held between foreign ministers. I bet it felt quite different.
Oh, well, I can't tell you how primitive the communication system were. In particular, some of the most important meetings, early meetings, when you turned up, you'd stand in a field about half a mile from where the meeting was taking place.
And if you were lucky. Actually in a field.
Actually in a field. and I used to say, thank God for the Luxembourgers or the Irish, because they would have pity on us or some other delegation and would tell us a bit of what's going on, enough to make a story. One then had to move to a pub of some kind, get a phone to get through to London and hope that your money wouldn't run out before you dictated your copy.
Did you have to like race each other to the pub, get to the phone first, try and get your copy in before the telegraph?
There was a bit of that. When the official meetings, the regular council meetings began, that became organised on a vast scale.
They let you actually go indoors and not stand in a field.
Indoors with free booze and...
Free booze? And food. Well, there were press conferences.
There were... Yes.
Times have changed.
Yes,
what sort of booze would they give you? Glass of champagne on the way in?
Wasn't champagne. You could get a Belgian beer or a coffee or a sandwich.
What did you usually have?
The occasional Belgian beer did help to while away the long hours.
And pretty soon after you went there in 1974...
After Mrs. Thatcher had seen her son off to his accountancy studies, the daughter on her way to law examinations...
The Tories, interestingly, in 1975, elected as leader Margaret Thatcher...
She set off for the House of Commons to begin the process of setting up her office as the new leader of the opposition.
While Labour, in power, decided to go for a referendum. What was that about?
Well, the Labour Party was split on whether to join or not to join. And the opinion polls, until the actual day of the referendum, showed quite a strong majority against accepting membership. Heath had negotiated entry, so legally we were in, but it was subject to a confirmatory referendum. Harold Wilson insisted on that.
Britain was taken into the common market by our predecessors after they had pledged they would not do so without the full-hearted consent of the British people, and that consent was manifestly neither forthcoming nor even sought.
And he said this deal isn't good enough.
We felt the terms were grossly inadequate.
I can negotiate a better set of arrangements.
At the end of that process, we would ask the British people to decide.
And, of course, the referendum was carried by a huge majority.
Yes is now showing at 67% and the no vote at 33%.
Signifying a massive yes right across the country.
Among the people who were most ardently campaigning for joining was Margaret Thatcher.
It's absolutely vital that everyone should turn out in this referendum and vote yes, so that the question is over once and for all. We are really in Europe and ready to go ahead.
That's interesting. Margaret Thatcher, then the newly elected leader of the opposition, who would become Prime Minister within 4 years. You say she was pro-European, but a lot of people now think of her as Eurosceptic. Did you come across her much?
I mean, I saw a lot of Margaret Thatcher during the years she was Prime Minister because she spent so much time in the European Union. So we were part of a caravan, in a way, moving with her. She was a strong pro-European until after Britain appeared to have one of its successes. Because one of the early things that she was persuaded to do was to push hard for the single European market, abolishing all, both physical and indirect, as well as direct barriers on trade and investment. But she suddenly realized that what was happening was the economic levers of power were shifting from national capitals because of the creation of a single economy. You have to have some decision-making covering a myriad of industries and services.
I'll only say that those countries, like the Soviet Union, which have tried to run everything from the centre, are now learning that success depends upon dispersing power and decisions away from the centre.
So she then tried to stop it. She tried to say, OK, I made a mistake. We've got to stop this.
A centralised European government would be a nightmare.
And she couldn't stop it. But then she went public in her famous Bruges speech.
We British are as much heirs to the legacy of European culture as any other nation.
In which she repeated something she had said to us. We were having a drink.
Where was it? Describe it.
She had a special room where they used to sort of rest when they weren't needed in the negotiating chamber. She was quite a big drinker. Liquor had to be provided. And we were talking to her, and she'd actually answered to something I asked. Why are you're adopting a much more hostile tone than you used to adopt? And she said, Mr. Palmer, I haven't worked so hard to halt the threat of socialism at the front door, to acquiesce in it sneaking in through the back door, meaning the European Union, which she then went on to repeat in slightly different words in her actual Bruges speech.
We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain, only to see them reimposed at a European level.
Margaret Thatcher had essentially gone in front of your eyes as a Brussels correspondent from someone who was incredibly pro-EEC as a trading organisation to someone who had become quite sceptical.
Yes, it took a number of years. It was also accelerated by the disputes about Britain's budgetary payments to the European Union. The fact is, as more countries came into the European Union who were by and large poorer, Germany's contribution went up enormously, France's contribution went up enormously, but so to a lesser extent did the British contribution. And that she found unacceptable. That was to her an outrage. Even though Britain was a major beneficiary of many of the policies.
What we are asking is for a very large amount of our own money back.
That battle you're talking about was the battle that resulted in us getting the rebate.
Yes, and this caused a lot of resentment in countries that didn't get that concession.
So this was the beginning of a slightly more troubled relationship, perhaps.
That's right. Episodically troubled, and every concession never quite satisfying. The trouble rumbles on. At about this time, the movement for the single currency was beginning to develop in a big way. And this, Margaret Thatcher saw as absolutely unacceptable, a battle she had to win.
Mr. Delors said at press conference the other day that he wanted the European Parliament to be the democratic body of the community.
And that's when she stood up in the House of Commons and said, no, no, no.
No, no, no.
So the Tories had taken us into what they thought was going to be a great trade relationship and then had watched in horror as Europe fast-forwarded towards a more federal system.
That's right. I mean, I wouldn't say they were fast-forwarding. Many Federalists thought they were moving very slowly in that direction. But to Mrs. Thatcher and to people of like mind, it seemed to be an express train.
By then, Euroscepticism is really speeding up within the Tory party. But from your perspective in Brussels, what was the EEC doing for Britain?
Well, of course, it was providing some of the most powerful impulses for economic and social development. It was creating a framework for what became later social standards, trade union rights, environmental standards, that came a bit later, which the UK individually had proved unable to achieve on its own, as other countries had failed on their own. But collectively, it became possible to do things.
And that's interesting because there was clearly a shift on the left. Many had been deeply Eurosceptic. They saw the European Economic Community as a capitalist club. Even a young Tony Blair in 1983 put out leaflets promising to leave the EEC because, I quote, it had drained natural resources and destroyed jobs. Was there a significant moment that changed that?
I think the most important moment came when Jacques Delors addressed the TUC Congress, because he made what Margaret Thatcher saw as a deliberate attempt to create a pro-European opposition to her policies. And I don't think she ever forgave him for that. Delors was particularly influential at that time because everybody knew he'd been behind the new laws on workers' rights. So he got an enormously positive response, and the whole conference stood up and sang. They sang Frère Jacques, which was probably the only French song that any of them knew.
And I'm really interested that in 1990, that led to a Sun front page. Up yours, Delors.
Up yours, Delors. Oh, yes. The Sun pioneered the creation of Jacques Delors as the enemy within. The Sun's move at that point and the kind of standards it set in tabloid journalism, which were taken up and imitated by others, became very, very important. And at first, there was amazement in Berlin, Paris, Brussels, The Hague, when they read British newspapers coming out with this sort of stuff. They were genuinely absolutely amazed. But then after a while, it kind of, they said, well, that's what's happening in England. This is very difficult.
So by then, the Labour Eurosceptic troublemakers, if you like, had become a less significant voice. But things were much more febrile on the right. Thatcher had gone, and then cue John Major's bastards enter the stage.
What we're saying to the government is there's more of this in store unless they look for a solution. And there is a solution. If the government agree to a referendum, the rebellion is over, they can get the bill through very quickly indeed, and there'll be no more trouble.
What was that all about?
Well, that was all about the upwelling of a more determined right-wing opposition, no longer complaining from the side, but obstructing in Parliament. The Treaty of Maastricht stands out very strongly.
The wording of the motion for the debate next week gave one small concession to the Euro rebels. It didn't mention the Maastricht Treaty itself.
He didn't disguise the intense alienation he and his right wing had for each other. I mean, they were not on speaking terms. It was There was no attempt made to cover that up. It was simply a fact.
MPs left Westminster for their constituencies after a tumultuous week, with the government's future still hanging in the balance.
The weight of the right wing in the Conservative Party grew to the point where his government became impossible.
Parliament must put this stalemate over Europe behind it.
And it was a kind of warning of what might come.
I am not prepared to let it poison the political atmosphere any longer.
And of course, at this time, he also had the tabloid press to deal with on Europe. And that tabloid press influence grew when the tabloid nature of the Daily Telegraph's coverage became more and more of a political factor.
Correspondents like Boris Johnson of The Telegraph, who daily observed...
Boris Johnson's role in Brussels during those years was not without some importance.
Britain just leapt into the lifeboat, jumped out of the ERM...
Did you come across Boris Johnson much?
Only every day. I mean, literally, because our day was determined by the framework of the Commission's daily briefings and then the myriad of other meetings. If you'd asked me about the Johnson family before Boris arrived with his holy war against Europe, I would have said they were a strongly pro-European family with federalist leanings. Indeed, Stanley Johnson, who was the director of environmental policy in the 1970s in the Commission, he introduced the first supranational piece of European environmental legislation ever brought forward, which was the Fecal Coliform in Water Directive. I can remember the name for some reason, even now. It was about obligatory standards of water cleanliness. So it was a little bit of a surprise when his offspring arrived to represent the Daily Telegraph.
And what did you make of him? Did you get on? Did you go for dinner, have drinks?
Well, as I say, our lives were very much thrown together, and he was writing more and more sort of grotesque rubbish. I remember one story about the Commission will insist that British fishermen have to wear women's hair nets for health and safety reasons.
Did they insist on that?
No, it was complete nonsense.
Did you ever ask him about these things?
Yes, I mean, you know, he had a hail fellow well met. Oh, it's all a jolly jape. He would turn up late to meetings. I mean, frankly, the people who were driven mad by him were not the likes of me, but the British officials and politicians who would see this kind of sub-sun tabloid invective appearing in the sober columns of the Daily Telegraph. I thought he was discrediting the Eurosceptic line. Actually, I may have been mistaken in that view.
So Boris Johnson is still a journalist in Brussels at the time. So are you.
When the curtain falls, it's time to get off the stage. And that is what I propose to do.
John Major arguably becomes the second or maybe even third Conservative Prime Minister whose downfall is inextricably linked to Europe.
We want a people's Europe. Free trade, industrial strength, high levels of employment and social justice.
We have the rise of New Labour and Tony Blair. How did that change things in Brussels?
At first, it looked as though it was going to change things quite significantly because Labour's stance was much more willing to pursue a stronger European social policy.
But we cannot shape that Europe unless we matter in Europe.
Stronger environmental policy and various other areas. But
I know there will be a hard choice to come over a single currency.
Funny enough, under Tony Blair, there were no great crises moments which would have put him on the spot as to whether or not he was going to really commit to a much more overtly supportive attitude for closer European integration. Blair never went that far and rather held back against it at a time when it could have made a big difference had Britain been more positive.
Jennifer Rankin, you've been a correspondent on and off in Brussels since 2006, now with The Guardian. At the start, Euroscepticism was raging among Tory members. And when he became leader, David Cameron took a pretty radical step. He pulled his party out of the moderate centre-right grouping in the European Parliament. Part of the pressure on him came from UKIP leader Nigel Farage, who was already by then a member of the European Parliament. What did politicians in Brussels make of him?
I think for a long time, Nigel Farage was treated as a bit of a joke, a figure of fun. He did things that nobody had ever done in the European Parliament before. He and his MEPs, they would bring little Union Jacks and put them on their tables in the main plenary chamber. And this was regarded as very sort of un-European. And he had some really memorable clashes.
You have the charisma of a damp rag.
He once called Herman Van Rompuy, then the president of the European Council, a damp rag.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, all of you.
Tony Blair, when Blair was giving a speech to MEPs.
Prime Minister, 6 months ago, you came here, you impressed everybody with your reform agenda, even me.
But Blair took Farage on and, you know, much to the delight of all the MEPs in the room who were really sick of Farage.
This is the year 2005, not 1945. We're not fighting each other anymore. These are our partners, they're our colleagues, and our future lies in Europe.
And he also had a peculiar relationship with Jean-Claude Juncker when he was president of the European Commission.
We're told that you like a drink and you're a smoker.
They've always had this kind of curious bromance, you might call it.
We couldn't care less. We've even seen...
Do you have a cigarette, please?
They often seem to enjoy the theatricality of their meetings. He was very adept at using the European Parliament as a stage in order to promote UKIP and then the Brexit Party agenda. And I think that's really underappreciated, the role that the European Parliament has played in building British Euroscepticism.
That's the last time you are applauding here.
And all of that added up to a lot of pressure on Cameron as Prime Minister, who instigated a massive row with Brussels in 2011 when he tried to veto an EU-wide treaty, but the other countries went ahead anyway. He then faced rebellion after rebellion in Parliament. UKIP topped the European election polls in 2014.
We will give the British people a referendum with a very simple in or out choice.
All of which helps explain how we ended up with that offer for an EU referendum.
It is time for us to settle this question about Britain and Europe.
But before he got there, Cameron said he would renegotiate our position in the EU. Was that negotiation a sham?
I don't think it was a sham. And I actually think on Cameron's own terms, it was a success and was seen in Brussels as some big and important concessions that cemented the UK's special status. But it was never something that resonated with the public. And what had been front and centre of the public debate was whether he was going to get restrictions on free movement of people. And on that, he utterly failed.
All of which is really interesting because the rumour that has gone round since then is that the last thing David Cameron told European leaders before he returned to take on that referendum was that he was a winner. But we all know what happened next.
Well, at 20 minutes to five, we can now say the decision taken in 1975 by this country to join the common market has been reversed by this referendum to leave the EU.
The British people have made a choice. That not only needs to be respected, but those on the losing side of the argument, myself included, should help to make it work.
Jennifer, for you, it must have been a crazy time to be a Brussels correspondent.
It was and is a remarkable time, and I feel it is a real privilege, actually, to get the sort of the view of history as it unfolds. On the morning of the 24th of June, there were people in the European Commission headquarters crying. I mean, and Brits and non-Brits alike. It was a real shock for people here and caused enormous sadness. And I think we will have a sense of that again next week.
And what's happening now? I mean, we are days away from leaving the EU. I know we're going to go into transition, but are you seeing the Union Jacks being packed away, offices cleared out, stationery reprinted? Are there any physical signs of departure?
Not yet, because everyone's waiting for the moment. Everyone's sort of drawing in their breath and you know, waiting for when the clock moves to midnight on the 31st of January. But of course, all the plans are underway. There are people who are currently making sure that the UK will not be showing up on an EU website as a member state country. There are people sort of making sure that British diplomats will not be on an email list for EU internal secret memos. there are all sorts of discussions about what's happening with the flags, which is interesting a lot of the journalists. And we know that one of them in the European Parliament is going to be sent to the House of History, which is the EU's funded museum in Brussels. I think a lot of them will be packed into cupboards, but packed into cupboards for foreign countries. So whenever Boris Johnson arrives, they can wheel out the British flag, but it will not be displayed anymore with the other member states.
Just finally, John, often we have people in here who are reporters, and you've been a reporter for many years, but as a reporter turned columnist, we know what you think. We know that you wrote in the pages of The Guardian in favour of the single currency. We know that you've supported a more federal Europe. In just a few days, Britain is going to leave the EU. How does that make you feel?
I think it's very sad for the British people. I think that they deserve better. I think that particularly the angry, dispossessed and the left behind, who should have been the priority for successive British governments in the past 20, 30 years, will be even more the losers from the gamesmanship of a Johnson government if he opts for the no deal. So I find that very dispiriting. All I can say is that Britain has taken a wrong turning with Europe in the past, but has found its way back. My instinct is it'll be after my time in the decades ahead. I suspect it'll find its way back again.
John, thank you very much.
Okay.
That was John Palmer, who was The Guardian's European editor for many years and later political director of the European Policy Centre, and our Brussels correspondent now, Jennifer Rankin, who told us she's going to be writing a lot about flags and other things too, I'm sure, so do follow her reporting. Now, if you like politics, why don't you come along to The Guardian's Labour leadership hustings in Manchester on February the 25th? I'm going to be hosting it, and I'd love to have some of your questions to put to the four candidates, if they all make it that far. Go to membership.theguardian.com. Coming up, the government defies US instruction on Huawei. Now, it's been a long time coming, but on Tuesday, the government finally decided to use Huawei, the controversial Chinese telecoms company, within its 5G network. There were some caveats, but the decision rejected the outright ban called for by the United States. With US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in London today, and with post-Brexit trade talks around the corner, this story is far from over, as The Guardian's defence and security editor Dan Saber explains.
Well, it's taken 9 months. Cabinet Minister even got fired at one point for leaking the preliminary decision. But finally, we have a government decision on Huawei, whether to allow it into 5G mobile phone networks or not. The decision is, well, what we expected it to be. That is to say, Huawei will be allowed in the non-core parts of the network, you know, antennas and base stations. But there'll be limits too. Huawei is also going to be prevented from supplying core and critical national infrastructure to military bases and nuclear power stations, that sort of thing. And perhaps this is the most interesting detail. There'll be a cap of 35% on Huawei's market share going forward. Not a total ban, which Donald Trump and the Americans wanted, because they were worried about Chinese surveillance, that kind of thing. But a cap nevertheless. And the reason 35% is interesting, it's the same level they are at now on 4G. So it means that Huawei, well, it can stay the same as it is in British mobile phone networks, but not get any bigger. So the big issue with Huawei is what kind of risk does it pose? It's a private Chinese company, but it doesn't have any public shareholders. It's owned by its own workers. The risk is, could the Chinese state take control of Huawei, either with the company's permission or perhaps around the back, and implement some program of mass surveillance on British citizens, or indeed other countries too? One of the reasons we're so worried about this is probably that it's the sort of thing that the UK and the US likes to do with other countries, as the Snowden revelations demonstrated. That's the worry and that's the concern. The question is, though, how far is that actually real? Well, Britain's intelligence agencies are absolutely sure that if there is any risk of Chinese state surveillance through Huawei, it can be mitigated, it can be defended against, it can be dealt with. But in the end, there's one other way that really helps, which is ensuring that Huawei doesn't become the dominant company, indeed the only company that can supply a mobile phone kit in the future. So that's where this 35% cap on its market share becomes really important. All that's well and good. But how will the United States, how will Donald Trump, that most unpredictable of world leaders, react? And this is the big question. What could the penalty be? Well, one possibility is the Americans might say, we're not going to share intelligence with you in the future or restrict the amount of intelligence sharing that we do. Well, on the US side, that would require congressional legislation, and the Republicans don't control both houses of Congress. And also, actually, British intelligence is also quite useful to the Americans. This idea of intelligence sharing isn't a one-way street. It's an area where Britain are nearly equal partners to the far better funded US. Nevertheless, Trump could also perhaps look at the post-Brexit trade talks that Britain is about to embark on with the US. Those start, of course, pretty much from next week. All these things mean that the debate about Huawei may actually be far from over, that Britain's decision, which it hopes is a final one, may actually be a preliminary one, and we could all be arguing about this for some months to come, depending on the resolve and anger of the Americans. The other question is Conservative MPs. Now, this is a decision the Conservative Party doesn't really like. There was a lot of Conservative unhappiness. Backbench MPs like Tom Tugendhat, Bob Seeley, Julian Lewis, all saying that they were really worried about Huawei. Tugendhat talked about allowing Huawei in to supply 5G would nest a dragon in the heart of our critical infrastructure. Evocative, lurid even language, not necessarily helpful to the overall debate. Notwithstanding, Boris Johnson's got a majority of 80, he's won the election handsomely, and for now, Boris Johnson is the master of all he surveys, and I think we'll be able to get this through. I think one of the interesting things about this debate is there's a sudden complaint, oh, why aren't there more choices in the market? Why has Huawei become the number one? The other companies, by the way, that are big in this game are Ericsson, Swedish firm, and Nokia, a Finnish firm. One of the reasons Huawei's done well is it's had really good financial support from the Chinese state. This is an industry for large companies, and large companies often need state support or help of some kind. So you've got to have a long-term strategic view, and the idea that you can sort of turn around and sort of walk away from Huawei and come up with replacements in anything under than a decade is fanciful. If Britain wants to engage in sort of fostering long-term competition to Huawei, then we'll probably need to find other countries to work with and a long-term approach to research and development.
That was our defence and security editor, Dan Saber. Do follow his reporting on this on the website. And that's it for today. But before we go, I do want to thank you for all the lovely messages on Twitter and elsewhere about our Life After Auschwitz episode on Monday. It's wonderful to know that so many of you felt as strongly as we did about Susan and Ivor's stories. Today's episode was produced by Rose Della Rabiti, Gregory Robinson and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.